people are literally fantasizing and romanticizing dictatorship evil regimes who take away every single basic human rights that we take here for granted. So I tell people, you have no idea what you're talking about. I was born and raised under this type of regime.
Welcome to the Miskav Institute for National Security's Mideast Horizons, the podcast for anyone who wants to truly understand what's happening in the Middle East beyond the spin and the headlines. I'm Lahav Harkov, your co-host, a Miskav Institute senior fellow and senior political correspondent for Jewish Insider.
And I'm Asher Fredman, your co-host and executive director of the Miskav Institute for National Security. The Miskav Institute is Israel's leading diplomatic and security policy center focused on strengthening Israel's national security, regional cooperation, and international partnerships. Every week here on Mideast Horizons, we cut through the noise and bring you fresh perspectives on the most urgent issues facing the Middle East and on the trends and opportunities developing in this incredible region.
We'd like to remind you to subscribe and follow wherever you listen to podcasts to keep up to date and ahead of the curve on anything connected to the Middle East. You can reach out to us with comments, suggestions, and of course, sponsorship opportunities at MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com.
We have an incredible and very timely guest today, Hevi Bouzou, a Syrian-American journalist, activist, who's working to build bridges between the Arab world and Israel, between Israel and Syria. And we have a fantastic conversation with her in today's episode. But before we dive into the interview with Hevi, Lahav, normally we talk about the Middle East, but there was an event this week in the United States in Tampa, Florida, which caught quite a lot of headlines. And that was the Turning Point USA conference that took place. People like Tucker Carlson, Dave Smith, Josh Hammer spoke. What are your thoughts on the controversy or the discussions around that event?
Well, first of all, I'll just zoom out a little for those of our listeners who might not know what Turning Point is. It's a conservative organization that's meant to sort of promote conservative political views, mostly on college campuses among young people. It was started by Charlie Kirk, who's a very popular and influential conservative figure, has also sort of been in President Trump's orbit to some extent, not in an official capacity, but somebody who I think sometimes has President Trump's ear. And he's like been this like central sort of MAGA figure. And he himself has been very, very pro-Israel to the extent that like he does campus tours all the time. That's like his main thing. And people come up and they challenge him about, you know, the war in Gaza. And he defends Israel, I think, always. So it's not shocking to have Tucker Carlson speaking at like a MAGA conference. But at the same time, it was kind of shocking in light of the way Tucker Carlson's been speaking lately about Israel and about, frankly, and about Jews, right? Like, he doesn't have to say, I hate Jews explicitly to make very clear that he does not view us very sympathetically. And then he was there on the stage talking about, you know, his usual spiel sort of about like, why do we have to do things for it? Why are we allied with Israel? Why do we have to give Israel aid? Why should we support them? And he then tied it in with Jeffrey Epstein. Jeffrey Epstein apparently had claimed in the past that he was a Mossad agent, and maybe he didn't even claim it. Maybe that's like a conspiracy theory too. I don't even want to give it credence because I haven't seen where he might have said it. But he, of course, brought up that sort of part of the whole Epstein conspiracy theory. And I almost hate to bring it up because I'm so sick of hearing about Jeffrey Epstein. Like, I understand why it's a big news story. A lot of the most rich and powerful people in the world are involved in sex cells, and the whole thing's disgusting, frankly, like nauseating. But I am really sick of hearing it. Like, every other podcast I listen to practically has talked about Jeffrey Epstein this week. So I don't want
to
get into that.
We are not going to talk about Jeffrey Epstein.
Correct. But we are going to talk about the anti-Semitism. Although I do want to, on one point, former Prime Minister Naftali Bennett actually tweeted out on the day we're recording this, which is Monday, July 14th. He tweeted out that Jeffrey Epstein is not a Mossad agent. He was like, Bennett was like, I would know if he was a Mossad agent. He was not a Mossad agent. Moving on from Epstein. So you had Tucker Carlson there spewing anti-Israel conspiracy theories.
So I watched Tucker Carlson's lengthy rambling rant against Israel, and I was trying to think, where is this coming from? And partly it's coming from wanting to be edgy, wanting to get clicks and views and create controversy. You know, if you're a young Republican or Republican public figure and you want to be edgy, so you're not going to talk about climate change. But what you can talk about is you can talk about Israel. You can criticize Israel because Israel is still very widely supported among most of the Republican Party. That's sort of a way of being edgy. But it was really interesting. At one point in this rant, he goes into a rant about how God looks at each individual individually, and he doesn't look at people as a people. And something struck me here, and this I think also connects to the Jeffrey Epstein thing.
I didn't see that. That like is, I think, like a real red flag of anti-Semitism, right?
Well, like, I think for many Americans, like the American Christians, this idea of Jewish peoplehood seems, I don't want to say many, for some, this idea of Jewish peoplehood seems suspicious or odd. Now, Jewish Americans, Jewish citizens of France, of the UK, are some of the most patriotic citizens of those countries. But it's true that for many Jews, there is a feeling of solidarity for their co-religionists or their co-people of their nation, and a feeling of solidarity towards the state of Israel. They can be critical, they can have, you know, they can like political parties, not like political parties, but they do feel a connection to Israel as the national homeland of the Jewish people. And that, I think, for us, for people who grew up in a Jewish environment, seems very, very natural. But for people who are looking at it from the outside, gives rise to all of these various conspiracies about Jewish, you know, secret groups meeting and planning. And I think Tucker Carlson is very much channeling that. And I think that is partly at the basis of some of the anti-Semitism that we've seen, because after October 7th, we've seen a rise in this identification with Israel by many Jews around the world, many young Jews around the world, not all, but many. And that's led to all these conspiracy theories about these, you know, groups of Jews that are controlling the world and controlling the banks. And I think that this identification with Israel is driving a lot of these conspiracy theories.
Yeah. And I mean, we don't need to get into like the counter arguments. I think anyone who's listening to us knows that, you know, whatever, there are Greek people who go to Greek language school and visit their grandparents in Greece every summer. Like, that's not something that people who listen to this podcast need to hear. But like the idea that these sort of dual loyalty accusations are being brought up in a forum that is, I don't know if mainstream is the word for it, but it's very popular and growing in influence, I would say, about Turning Point and sort of Turning Point alumni is really disconcerting. This podcast is new, but I think that you and I are people who worried about anti-Semitism on the left for years, and we still do, about BDS and campus anti-Semitism, which is rooted in the left. But this poison is really spreading on the right in the US as well. And it's scary. And it's something that, you know, we all need to sort of sound the alarm about and push back against. I think Josh Hammer did a really good job at that from briefly what I saw. And also in general, I was just listening to him on another podcast, and I thought that he does a very good job. And we need more people like that who have credibility in these circles. And that's maybe something that's better about the right than the American left right now, where someone like Josh Hammer could still have, and he's like a senior editor at Newsweek and a conservative podcaster and writer, can still have credibility in these circles where so many anti-Israel things are said, but the pro-Israel voice is still acceptable and normal, right? And on the far left, I don't know that there are pro-Israel voices that they would accept and be willing to hear. And so that's pretty scary as well.
Josh is great. And one of the statistics that he brought was that, I think it was a CBS poll, after the American operation in Iran, something like 94% of self-identified MAGA supporters supported President Trump's decision to bomb Iran. And Tucker was a prominent voice in warning about the thousands of American soldiers at the same time that Israel within 4 days had taken over Iranian airspace and was flying in Iranian airspace as if it was Tel Aviv. And Tucker and co. are still warning about, they have this idea of American weakness. America is so weak that Iran is going to be capable of inflicting massive harm on American servicemen and women and American interests. Thankfully, no American servicemen and women were at all injured during the course of the war. And we saw that in the end of the day, President Trump took the decision that was obviously good for American interests, also was good for Israeli interests in terms of setting back the Iranian nuclear program. And Tucker, in the end of the day, was ignored.
Yeah. And I think like Tucker realizes he was wrong about that. Like he's not going to admit it, but that's sort of why he's moved on to sort of uglier things. So, okay, Israel's not going to drag us into war now, but how about those IDF veterans who live among us in America? They're so fishy. It's really just odious.
Let's shift, I think, now into things that are maybe more important or maybe more connected to real life. We just got the news of another soldier, this one from Efrat, who fell in Gaza. And we've seen over the last several weeks and months, obviously over the last 21 months, but soldiers who have fallen in the line of duty. And I heard on another Israel-focused podcast, a left-wing journalist talking about how, I think the words used was that the Israeli public has crossed the Rubicon and is now supportive of ending the war. And in a sense, he's correct. But the problem is that he and his fellow left-leaning Israeli journalists that still dominate most of Israeli mainstream media talk about ending the war, talk about this idea that Hamas will no longer be in power, but are never able to explain what the consequences of ending the war now will be. And how, in any way, is Hamas going to be disarmed? Is Hamas no longer going to be in power?
And by the way, it's not just that they're not able to explain it on these podcasts. It's that when these polls are taken, the polls don't say that if that happens, Hamas will still control the Gaza Strip and it won't have laid down its arms and its leaders won't have been exiled, right? And I think that if the actual reality, that the actual things that are on the table right now in the negotiations were put forward, I don't think that nearly as many Israelis would say, oh, we want to end the war right now. I understand the fatigue, I think, as much as anyone. My husband has done 250 days of reserve duty, leaving me to be basically a single mom of three small children. It's not easy. Asher knows I had to interrupt the podcast recording now to deal with kids who weren't going to sleep when they were supposed to go to sleep. But I think a temporary ceasefire just draws things out, right? You have a 60-day ceasefire, then the war just has to begin again for us to actually meet our goals. And if you end it now, then that just means we're going to have another war sooner. So it's like, we should actually finish the job in Gaza. Whether the political will remains for that, I actually think it does. Like, I actually think that Netanyahu's coalition partners feel that way as well. But the public increasingly does not feel that way. And in part because I think that they're being somewhat misled about the consequences.
And with the Miskav Institute, we've consistently maintained the position that there are weighty arguments and very legitimate positions on all sides of this debate, strategic considerations, moral considerations, bringing the hostages home, which is obviously something that we all very much want to see, but that the debate, the discourse should be based on reality and not on illusions and not on wishful thinking. And let's be frank, if Israel ends the war now, the most likely scenario is that within a month, Hamas retakes control of much of the Gaza Strip. Within 2, 3, 4 months, we have rockets, we have cross-border attacks. Once again, we know, and I've spoken to some of the people who were in charge of these Gaza reconstruction mechanisms, that no matter what kind of international oversight was put in place, Hamas was always able to take the construction materials, the electronics, whatever it might be, for its own military uses. And the question really is, what happens 3 months down the line, 4 months down the line, when those rockets start firing, when people are wondering whether or not they should move back to the area around the Gaza Strip? What happens then? So we may not really be talking about an end of the war. We may be talking about a pause in the war. And again, there are weighty arguments on both sides. The bottom line is that the IDF, and I think I have some criticism on this, has sort of been taking a middle path. So we're not ending the war. On the other hand, it's not capturing and holding territory in a way that would be truly be necessary to eradicate the terrorist infrastructure. So I spoke to a few friends of mine who are serving in Gaza right now, and they say, what are they doing now? They are guarding trucks of aid in northern Gaza that they know are being handed over to Hamas. And they're saying, why should I be risking my life in order to hand over aid to Hamas? So there is that criticism, there is that fatigue, and there is these complexities, but the realities need to be recognized.
I want to know what your take is about the Yasser Abu Shabab militia. They have been sort of pushing against Hamas and securing certain zones in Gaza. And I had heard a few weeks, once this sort of came to light and became public, Avigdor Lieberman, the former defense minister, said that he is ISIS. And I don't think that that's actually true. I don't think there's any proof of that. But at the time in my, you know, journalism capacity, I had spoken to some experts on Palestinian society, and they didn't see indication that he was ISIS. But on the other hand, they said, like, he's a criminal, like he's a gangster. And so you're just letting someone who's like, you know, you're letting the mafia take over. But some Israelis are like, well, he's not Hamas, so that's better. I don't know what I think about it. So I'm wondering what you think.
Everybody's talking about the day after Hamas. And the question is, how do you create a reality like that? And there aren't too many people who really are friendly and peace-loving towards Israel in Gaza. But if there are people that we can work with, then we should. And one of the Israeli opposition politicians, not Lieberman, one of the others, said, why is the Morag corridor so important? Why is Netanyahu turning the Morag corridor into the be-all and end-all? And he, in my view, just totally doesn't understand the strategic implications, because when the IDF is between the Morag corridor and the Philadelphia corridor,
maybe just explain to our listeners what the Morag corridor is, because I think Philadelphia people know pretty well, but that's sort of it's like a relatively new concept even for Israelis and Hebrew speakers.
So if the Philadelphia corridor is the corridor dividing Egypt and the southern Gazan city of Rafah from the south, the Morag corridor is the corridor dividing Rafah from the west of the Gaza Strip to the north. And the idea is you create an area where Hamas no longer controls the population, where aid is not reaching Hamas, and you create almost a proof of concept, what it looks like to, and you break this reign of fear of Hamas in the Gaza Strip. And now if Israel pulls out of the Morag corridor, then Hamas will just swoop in. They're still the most powerful military force, and they will not only eliminate these families or these clans that are working with Israel, they will deter anybody else working with Israel in the future. But Lav, speaking about ISIS, yes, ISIS, leaders that may be ISIS, that may not be ISIS, we are seeing some very interesting progress with regards to Syria and reports of Israeli and Syrian leaders meeting. What is your take on the future of Israel-Syria relations?
So again, in my capacity as a journalist, I've spoken to some people about this just a few days ago. And it seems like at this point, what's on the table is a non-aggression pact, which is not normalization and not peace. But in effect, it would be a return to the situation last year, in the sense that it would involve Israel mostly withdrawing from the buffer zone to where Israel was sort of from 1974 until December of last year. And the Syrians would get, well, what they would get out of this is, I mean, they've already had sanctions lifted on them. And I think that they would get like major investments from the U.S. and possibly it would encourage other Western countries to try to invest in Syria's reconstruction. I do wonder what Israel gets out of this. I mean, we don't want to be at war with Syria, but we're not really at war with Syria anyway. And so wouldn't we be less secure if we pulled out of the buffer zone, right? So I would hope that this is something that's sort of gradual and that there would be sort of better guarantees or greater clarity of what Israel would get out of a deal like that. Because the sort of vague hope that one day there'll be normalization and peace is, I think, not enough.
That's, I think, a very, very good approach. At the Miskav Institute, we have been working with some of the senior decision makers on helping develop Israel's policy vis-a-vis Syria. And that has been our approach. That on the one hand, we need to be open to potential opportunities. We would like a peace with Syria. We certainly want a stable and quiet border with Syria. We want to keep Iran and other hostile countries out of Syria. But on the other hand, we don't want to take security risks with an untested regime led by a former Islamist leader. And that requires Israel to, at least in the near future, to remain in the buffer zones, to remain on the Syrian side of the Hermon, until we have better assurances that indeed this regime is going to stabilize, will remain in power, and will be able to create a more peaceful existence on our border.
And one more thing that we should note is that there's been some fighting between Bedouin tribes and Druze in southern Syria, and Israel intervened on the side of the Druze. Israel feels a responsibility to the Druze community in southern Syria because they are related to the Druze community in northern Israel. And I think this is something that could get in the way of a potential deal between Israel and Syria. You know, there's sort of often differing views on whether this is something that the new government in Syria tacitly supports or if they just don't have a handle on things. But I think our guest, Hevi Bouzeau, has an interesting perspective on this. Asher, you want to tell us a little bit about her?
Hevi Bouzeau is a truly remarkable woman who is working to build bridges across the Arab world, between Israel and the Arab world. She is the co-founder and executive director of Yala Productions, a dynamic platform dedicated to amplifying underrepresented voices from across the MENA region. She was born in Damascus. Her mother is from Aleppo. She has worked as a journalist in Syria, in regional Middle East media, and now in the United States. Through her Yala platform, she engages both with world leaders and in Arabic with youth across the Middle East. She's also visited Israel and helped bring voices from Israel, including from the hostage families, to the Arab world, in some cases for the very first time. She is a real trailblazer, and she will provide us with fantastic insights onto what's really happening in Syria, the prospects for restoring the momentum of the Abraham Accords, and the future of Israel-Syria peace and coexistence.
Hevi, thank you so much for being here. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about your background? What was it like growing up and working as a journalist in Syria? When did you come to the U.S. and what have the different experiences been like?
First of all, thank you so much for having me, Lahav and Asher. I'm really happy to be with you today. And my journey has been a long one, very complex one. So I was born in Damascus, Syria. I come from a mixed background. My father's half Kurdish. My mom is half Turkish. And I grew up in Damascus. They were very intellectual. They were liberal, which is not the case in Arab countries generally. So we were kind of like a small community. There's like a minority within minority. You know, it's like a very intellectual, artistic. We had friends of my family were like directors, actors, artists, painters, all of that. So this is, you know, like you have to imagine this is like a small segment of society that was in Damascus. And being from this complex and kind of, you know, minorities from both my sides of my family has also given me that like kind of different understanding of the realities in a country like Syria. But also you can only imagine, you know, having the kind of partly Kurdish and partly Turkish, you know how much they love each other, the Kurds and the Turks. So I literally grew up seeing also that kind of like those layers of conflicts that you don't really see or hear much about, except that they are there, you know, under the surface. And my mom was born and raised in the Jewish quarter in Aleppo. So I also grew up hearing the stories of what happened to her friends and neighbors growing up. And it opened my eyes to the fact that in these countries, in Arab countries, unfortunately, specifically in the time when I was, you know, born and raised, and it continues in a lot of ways, the truth was never actually told about what's going on, about different groups who are being oppressed, how like a certain identities were dominating everybody else. And of course, when you're under a dictatorship regime, your voice, your opinion is not only that something you can't have, but it's actually a threat. You could lose your life. You could lose everything. And that would make me want to become a journalist and share those untold stories.
Could you say a little bit more about that? Because I think that many people and many of our audience in the West, in Israel, in in Asia, doesn't have that experience of living under a dictatorship where you can get arrested, pulled off the street, thrown into prison, interrogated. Can you talk a little bit more so people can understand what it's like to live under that kind of regime?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I actually, this is one of the main things I like to talk about today, specifically to Western audience, because when you are born and raised under a democratic system, when your rights, you know, to kind of voice your opinion, to exercise your voting rights, where, you know, it's a kind of a given, right? You don't really realize what's on the other side. And what we've been seeing a lot is that people are literally fantasizing and romanticizing dictatorship, evil regimes who take away every single basic human rights that we take here for granted. So I tell people, you know, you have no idea what you're talking about. I was born and raised under this type of regime. Your voice and what's right and what's good, it doesn't matter. None of it matters because you literally, as a human being, have no value and there's no laws to protect you. You're like led by a mob that is, you know, in specifically like Syria, but like literally every kind of those oppressive, bloody dictatorial regimes, what they do is that they have the laws in their hands. So there's no accountability, no judicial system, no press to like shed light on any, you know, injustice. So your life and your like existence has no value and there's nothing you can do about it. So it's a really, really scary and not good place to be. So, you know, I just really always try to kind of let people know here how privileged and how lucky we are to be in this type of system, you know, where there is transparency, where there is democracy, where there is free press. Despite the, you know, imperfections and the conflicts and the polarization, yes, we are going through a lot, but we are still so privileged and so blessed, you know, in the West.
If I can give you a prompt, Betty Seinfeld.
Oh my God. So you know about this story?
I think you'd be interested to hear it.
I actually had the first English radio show in Damascus called Afternoon Drive on Mix FM. And on this show, we were talking, so it was me and a co-host, and we will talk afternoon, like it's a live show, and we will put music, like different, like, you know, whatever are the hits that are, you know, at that time. And people would ask for some songs that we will talk about, like psychology and relationships. And in one of the episodes, we were talking about people who have Syrian origins who made it in the world and were like a positive impact in the world. So I talked about Jerry Seinfeld's mother being Jewish, that originally your family came from Aleppo, which is kind of like my mom's family. So I talked about it and we get like live calls. So all of a sudden we started getting calls like, shame on you. How would you say this? Which is sounded very systematic because in the beginning we were getting just like regular calls. And then we started getting what we believed was like the Syrian regime's intelligence service saying like, shame on you. How could you like basically say something positive about somebody who's being Jewish? What about what's happening to the Palestinians? I was like, well, I'm talking about politics here. I'm talking about somebody who is Jewish, who his mom's family is from Aleppo.
And it's worth saying, like, this is long before Seinfeld came out as, like, super pro-Israel, right? Like, after October 7th, Seinfeld is, like, the super pro-Israel guy, but he wasn't outspoken. I mean, what year was this?
That was a long time ago. That was, like, 2000. Like, I'm going to tell you now my age, okay? So that was, like, around 2008.
Yeah, so, like, it was, like, nobody was associating Seinfeld with Israel then.
Well, but anyway, he was just famous for Seinfeld because everybody loves Seinfeld and what shit, like, all over the world. So I just basically was talking about Seinfeld, the famous, very funny comedian, you know, and mentioned that. And then after that, I actually was called by the owner of the radio station who, because like, so in Syria, the system is if you want to have a business, you had to be partner with the Assad regime. If the person doesn't partner with the Assad regime, they're out. And that's how Orient, the TV station I was working for later, was shut down. So he was telling me, he's like, they're going to get us shut down. They called me and they're going to get us shut down. Why did you do this? And I was like, what did I do? Like, I literally just spoke about somebody who is Jewish, whose ancestry and family comes from Aleppo. Like, what is the crime here? And he said, I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to give you this show anymore. I can give you the morning show. And he knew that I was going to school, so I couldn't do the morning one. So he was like, I'm sorry then, you know, too bad. He fired me. And I literally lost my job because I spoke about Jerry Seinfeld and his mother being from, her family being from Aleppo.
Jerry, if you're listening to this, we'd love to have you on to talk about memories that you heard from your mother growing up in Aleppo.
That would be wonderful. I would love to be a guest, a co-guest with you guys. Horrible.
Yeah, that just imagine having Seinfeld on the podcast. That would be like a dream.
I know.
Havy, I want to ask you, when did you come to the U.S. and how did that happen?
So that's a long story. It was through, I believe, God's journey. Put me on this journey. It was like a family circumstances. I came here as a teenager. So I moved to the U.S. as a teenager, became a U.S. citizen, and I actually went to Santa Monica College. I lived in California for a while. I went first to San Luis, Missouri. So I saw the people in the Midwest, the amazing people.
Which is where the Fredman family is from, by the way. I should point that out. My grandfather, my great-grandfather also came as immigrants to St. Louis.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
And I love the people in St. Louis. They were like, that was my first impression of the American people. And it was just such a lovely, sweet, helpful, just caring people. And I was like, oh my God, I fell in love with the American people right away. And then I actually went to California. And then I went back to Syria because I wanted to have my career in journalism. And that I did that radio show. And I had two TV shows. One called The Access is After. So I had two TV shows, one called Dramatech and one called In Plus Out. In Plus Out was like more about like, you know, it's kind of like a magazine show. You talk about like what's going on in the, you know, TV industry, all of the developments, the new series, all of that, like cultural things, events. And then Dramatech, that was in Damascus. Dramatech was in Dubai and it was a game show. But that was when Orient was basically struggling with the Assad regime and it was shut down by the Assad regime inside of Syria. And then the uprising happened against the Assad regime. And that's when I actually had to flee and come back to the U.S.
It's actually incredible that we're talking today, because if this conversation had been happening a year ago, then this conversation might look very different. In November 2024, the Assad regime fell. I had just come out of, I was serving in Lebanon. We just got out of Lebanon, and all of a sudden we heard the news that the regime in Syria has fallen.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever expect the regime to fall and to fall so quickly?
I've always known that it will not last. And I knew that it is not going to last for long. I didn't expect it to fall that quickly. I didn't see that happen. It was very historic. It was very joyful moment. And the father who sadly passed away, he was actually still with us. And that was his dream. Since I remember, you know, my father, you know, was against the Assad regime. So he got to see this happen. And this is definitely, you know, of course, now we have a lot of kind of, you know, it's a very complex issue, as you guys could probably already have that opinion. But it is very historic and very positive moment.
I want to know what your impression is of the new president of Syria, al-Shara, in Israel. You know, at first they called him a jihadi in a suit because of his background with al-Qaeda. But now they've sort of softened that language, and it seems like the government is cautiously optimistic about him, let's put it that way. How do you think the people of Syria, especially the young people of Syria, view him? We also had a previous guest on the podcast, Johnny Moore, who met with al-Shara about a month ago. And he thought that he was very sort of forward looking and compared him to MBS in Saudi Arabia. So, well, what's your impression?
I mean, look, you know, obviously in the beginning, it was like, whoa, you know, like we have now the former ISIS, former al-Qaeda leader of this, you know, entity, HTS, basically ruling Damascus. So that's definitely a scary moment. I am from the school of thought of you have to verify first and then trust. And I think that, yes, we have to, if this person has been saying consistently, you know, and basically making steps, including these historic meetings with Israeli officials to coordinate and to collaborate on security issues as a first step, I think that this is a major historic opportunity. And I do agree that we need to kind of follow and see how the steps on the ground are going to be translated, and if, you know, how actual like steps will happen, the results that will come out of it. I mean, you know, the verification process, I think it's really important at this point to assure that these really important steps that this new leader in Damascus has talked about and has made in terms of the relationships with the United States, with Israel, creating this security alliance right now, because I think this is a really important issue that we have to navigate, because the Iranian regime has been using Syria as a military base to launch terrorist attacks against Israel. Of course, they slaughtered tens of thousands of people in Syria, hundreds of thousands, actually. With Hezbollah. And for the first time in history, Syria is no longer, especially like talking about the recent history in the last few decades, is no longer a puppet of the Iranian regime. And it's no longer a military base for the Iranian regime. And it's not on that side. Now we're seeing this major shift. But as you know, Syria is complex. We have different minority groups that exist in Syria. Even though al-Shara and like his foreign minister Shaybani are saying and doing all these things, we want to assure that they have control over the radical elements that still exist within even the ranks or even the supporters of this kind of former HGS. So It's a complex, and it's a very important process, and we need to assure that it does kind of go, you know, through and kind of get us to the other side. But I think that the trajectory of how things are moving right now, despite the fact that, like I said, it's a complex issue, we're dealing with many layers that are happening today, like what's happening in southern Syria today with the Druze, that we are, I think, in the right, kind of going in the right direction. I hope this is not too long.
No, it's fascinating. It's very important. When you look at the new regime's approach and concrete steps, both vis-a-vis the Kurds in the north, the Druze in the south, other groups, what is your impression to date?
I think that they need to do better in terms of approaching the different minority groups. Look, in Syria, that we've had an Arab nationalist, socialist dictatorship that was terrorizing people for a very long time. And they did come from a minority group, which was the Alawites. And they treated people in that way, which was like a minority that is an Alawite that was slaughtering the majority that were the Sunni. But then they also abused every other minority, including other Alawites that were not part of that system, that like regime system. So you're already talking about a country that is very divided on a sectarian, tribal, and ethnic level. So, you know, we're not starting from like a clean slate. And having Ahmed al-Shara come from HTS doesn't help assure minority groups. Now, we also have to remember that Turkey and Qatar played a role in making them the strongest force in Syria throughout the conflict, you know, basically the uprising against the Assad regime that turned into an armed conflict with the Assad regime. They were the ones who ended up being the most powerful because they also eliminated the more moderate ones. So when you're now trying to rebuild something that is already completely broken, you want to approach it in a very sensitive, delicate way. The Kurdish issue is a complex one. We have the PKK, who are a terrorist organization, who have harmed the Kurdish cause more than any other, in my opinion, more than any other country or group, because they have, in Syria specifically, they used to help the Assad regime and the Iranian regime in actually oppressing Kurds, who were against the Assad regime. Like, they were their kind of the military, like, intelligence arm of the Assad regime. And even though the U.S. worked really hard on kind of separating the SDF, maybe not enough, actually, if we're going to be frank about this, the U.S. probably should have played a more forceful role in trying to separate between the SDF and the PKK. The fact that the PKK is being dismantled is a very positive thing. I think it's also very positive things for the Kurds in Turkey, because they also harmed the Kurdish cause in Turkey, in my opinion. That said, you know, when we are dealing right now with, we have Islamic radical elements that are in Syria, that now the Syrian new army is going to be bringing on some of those elements. They have to basically bring everybody to make sure that this is a kind of regular, like, orderly army and not just different entities that are, like, loose with weapons all around the country. So that's important. But at the same time, you know, how are you going to build a trust between these Islamic elements and the Kurds who have been killing each other for the last 10 years? How are you going to be asking the Kurds to trust the national, the Syrian National Army, which is another battalion militia that's supported by Turkey that was slaughtering the Kurds? And they literally committed ethnic cleansing in Afrin, which is in northern Syria. So you cannot ask the Kurds to go and kind of be fragmented and go to the Syrian army as individuals when they literally could be killed by these other elements that are also a part of the same Syrian army. So it's a complex issue. I think we have to address it very carefully, and we have to address the concerns by the Kurds that they cannot trust to be in the same unit with a person who ideologically believes that he should kill them. And of course, we need to assure that in the meanwhile, that this connection with the PKK has to be cut off because it's been hurting the Kurds in Syria. So that's one issue, right? Now, you know, if we talk about the Druze, the same thing. You know, we've seen some actual massacres that happened after the fall of the Assad regime against the Alawites and against the Druze. There's a lot of tensions between the Druze and the Bedouins in the south. And the tensions between the Druze and the Bedouins in the south of Syria is a very old situation. It's not during only the Assad regime or now with the Ahmed al-Sharaa being in power. This is an ongoing situation. They've had conflicts. You know, Syria, like I said, is a country that is tribes and different ethnic and sectarian groups and religious groups. So they have had historic conflicts. Those conflicts are now back. And the Ahmed Sharaa forces, they sent like a unit to fight it off. And when there's no trust, the Druze already have missed in distrust for the government in Damascus, because so far they've had those Islamic elements that seem to be, you know, very present, very obvious. And then there was no accountability for the atrocities that were committed before. So they fought against them immediately. And then now we have a conflict going on in the south where the Syrian government should have actually sent a reconciliation delegation. I think that would have been the right approach, to try to have both sides talk and for them to be mediators rather than going, you know, with the armed forces and also looking like they are Islamic. That's not going to make the Druze feel safe and comfortable. Yeah. And obviously they're going to subjugate them to maybe violations, even if they're not ordered from the top, but they have been and they were committed from the bottom. So again, it's a complex issue, but I think we have to be very, it's important that we are sensitive and nuanced in how we approach dealing with different minority groups in Syria, and kind of if there's trust to be built, how is that trust being rebuilt?
As we're speaking, Israel is weighing sort of some kind of response to violence against the Druze population in southern Syria, because Israel feels a special responsibility for them due to the Druze population of Israel, which also, you know, serves in Israeli military. We have a lot of high-ranking officers who are Druze. This seems like a clear obstacle to some sort of agreement between Syria and Israel, even though negotiations are ongoing. I was wondering how likely you think some kind of agreement is between Syria and Israel, and most of the experts I've spoken to think that any agreement would probably mean just a return to the situation of last year, where Israel would just go back to the 1974 ceasefire lines. Do you think that there's hope for something more than that, normalization or peace?
I definitely have that hope personally. I think that having peace and normalization on a deep level is the only way forward. We've had the indoctrination of dictatorship, bloody regimes who've been wanting to just kind of continue a state of hatred and animosity towards Israel, blaming Israel for all the bad things that they were doing to the people in Syria. And this was across the Middle East, across Arab countries, right? And now we have a moment in history where this regime is no longer there. But not only that, you have a population that has realized in many ways that everything that this regime was feeding them are actually lies. And you see rising number of voices on social media and the Arabic language calling out for this peace with Israel, acknowledging that Israel is basically has a very old and ancient history in its land, that the Jewish people have also like the history that was in Arab countries that nobody ever talked about. Like when I talk about what happened to my mom's friends and neighbors growing up, you would never hear or see anything about this anywhere in the Arabic language, media, education, curriculum, nothing. It's nowhere to be found. I knew it just because it happens that my mom was born and raised there. So people are learning and are realizing that the access of the Iranian regime is the terrorist access. And that's the access that has actually been killing them and been destroying the region. And then on the other side, there's Israel, the superpower who's been fighting off this evil and has actually liberated these countries. Like talking about Syria and Lebanon, we cannot deny the fact that now people are more free today because Israel, after October 7th, was like, that's it. We're not going to take this anymore. We're going to get rid of this terrorism in this region. And I think this is acknowledged by all Arab countries right now. And this is a time in history where we need to utilize this change and actually facilitate this deeper normalization. There are ancient synagogues in Syria. You know, Syria is like, when you talk about like the Jewish history, I think there's like really ancient synagogues in Damascus and in Aleppo that are dated probably as old or even older than the ones in Israel.
One of the oldest Torah scrolls, the oldest like Bibles in the world, came from Aleppo, famously.
Aleppo Codex.
That's a good segue. Could you tell us, as co-founder and executive director of Yala Productions, Yala, you're very active on social media, engaging these voices in Arabic. Could you tell us a little bit about what you're doing and what you're hoping to accomplish via Yala?
Definitely Yala is about this, is about kind of bridging this gap through education, soft content, storytelling, literally doing all the things that Arab media should have done a long time ago that has not been doing, and utilizing the fact that we have social media now. Now, social media, of course, is a double-edged sword because a lot of disinformation is being spread on social media. But at the same time, for the first time, people in Arab countries are actually accessing information directly and not having to go through the channels and the, you know, Arabic language media that has been dominating and controlling the narrative for the last few decades. So this is why Yala is so important, because there is a shift and we're just capitalizing and bridging and empowering this shift. Traditionally in Arabic countries, including the ones that had peace with Israel, like Egypt and Jordan, if you have somebody who is pro-peace with Israel, let's say, there was a very famous Egyptian writer, his name is Ali Salem, who said, I want peace with Israel, and he went and visited Israel. And that was after the signing of the peace agreements between Egypt and Israel. He was punished for doing this. Ali Salem, who's one of the most talented writers in Egypt history, was completely marginalized. He wasn't able to create any more televised or, you know, cinema or any of the work that he was doing. Actually, he created some of the most successful dramas and comedies, he was not allowed to continue his career because he visited Israel. So people who actually spoken and said, we want peace with Israel, we want to work with Israel and to collaborate with Israel, we're not like just create a new region that is peaceful, that is hopeful, that is prosperous, were punished. So for the first time with the Abraham Accords, the countries that signed it, like the Arab countries like the UAE, Morocco, Bahrain, are not saying that. They're saying this is a people-to-people peace. So we're capitalizing on this. And I absolutely think that we have, it's the right time that we expand this to other countries, and including Syria. Absolutely. I think a lot of Arabs right now are jealous of the Abraham Accord countries because they feel like, why not us too, you know? And people in Syria, we did a video recently between Yalla and Builders of the Middle East, which is another platform that we collab together. And we've had people in Syria ask that question, do you want peace with Israel? And we've had an overwhelming response from the people who were willing to speak on camera. Some people were scared to speak on camera, but they were saying yes. One of the people that we didn't even include in the video said the Jewish state. He said, I want to, you know, have peace with the Jewish state. So you have a major shift, but nobody is capitalizing on it yet. And I think that if you have a peace agreement, look, and I agree with you that there is complexity. Now we're talking about the details in terms of the Druze, in terms of, you know, the kind of the security aspect of what does the normalization look like? Because normalization looks like that, you know, how it would actually translate. You have to make sure that the mosques are not preaching hatred towards Israel on Fridays, that the curriculum is changed to make sure that the same narrative of hatefulness and anti-Semitism and wanting to destroy Israel is no longer taught, the same thing in the media. So also reopen synagogues. Also allow the Jewish people to go back to get their properties. There's so many things, right? And then you can have collaborations, you can have projects, you can build, you can create educational initiatives. So there is an opportunity for all of these things. Of course, there has to be details about how to get to this agreement and what it would look like. But let me tell you this. Like Sunnis in Syria, the Arab Sunnis, and all minority groups are feeling this sense that if we are moving away, and this is literally based on what I've seen on social media, people I've spoken to, if we move away from the Iranian regime access and have a relationship with Israel, this is where the hope, this is where the peace, where the prosperity, where the stability, everything that they didn't have before, this is where they would have it. And there is a sense that also minorities feel that if Israel has a relationship with Syria, that they will be safer. Israel is, unlike Turkey, is actually trusted by minority groups. They look towards Israel because in Israel, minorities are protected. The way Israel deals with things is not comparable to how a regime like the Assad regime, or of course, these elements that now we're hopefully like we can move away from, treat people who believe differently, who
have... Just point out that you, unlike some experts like Dave Smith, for example, have actually come to Israel and have actually seen the country and met the people. So you know what you're talking about firsthand.
That actually brings me to a question, which is, I mean, these like, you know, young Arab adults or people who are watching Yalla, like they have mostly been exposed to media and imams and an education system that is so deeply anti-Israel. Like, how willing are they to accept the reality that you're showing them? And when they are willing to listen, what are they most curious about? What do they want to know about Israel?
That's a very good question. They have, like, what happened in Syria, and that's what I talk about, is that unlike other Arab countries, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, and Yemen, these countries for the last almost two decades have been literally subjugated to the abuse and destruction of the Iranian-backed militias, the Iranian occupation. These countries specifically has realized that all of this so-called axis of resistance, where the Iranian regime, Hezbollah, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, all of the IRGC-backed militias, and of course, all I respect militias in Iraq, you know, very like kind of powerful because there they have funding, that they have been their enemies for the last decade and a half, you know, and going, ongoing, right? So because of that, this has made a shift in how people, even with the, all of the education system, all of what they've heard from in the mosques, all of those, the web of lies have collapsed in the last decade and a half. So there's a lot more readiness that you would see on the ground from voices rising in Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon. Yemen, of course, but Yemen is harder to access information. But, you know, you hear it from people who are away, who are able to, who are safe to talk. So it's basically this type of influence that shifted the public opinion. The countries who did not, that's why you see like there's a relapse in countries like Egypt, Jordan, even Kuwait, you know, because they have been away, they've been safe from this evil, and they could just literally like preach from afar. It's kind of like here in the West, like you have people who are like looking at, you know, from afar and kind of preaching about something that they have no idea about. But when the people actually live through it and they know what's actually happening, they know who's killing them, they know who's abusing them, who's stealing their, you know, hope, their money, their future, right? And killing them on sectarian basis just because they're Sunni, just because they're Christian, right? So they have seen what happened. Then they have social media, so they start learning. Okay, well, how does Israel treat minorities? Well, Israel takes care of mosques. The Muslim minority in Israel has been growing tremendously, right? Christians the same. It's actually the fastest growing population of Christians is in Israel. And in the other country, which is ironic, Iran, but in secrecy because people are hating this kind of the Islamic ideology that the Islamic Republic of Iran represents, that they started converting to Christianity in secret. But Israel is basically like fostering and taking care of all of its minority groups. Of course, the Druze, you mentioned the Druze. The Druze are the most participant, integrated minority in Israel. And it's not the same. Like in Syria and Lebanon, they're afraid, you know? And then we know that the Golan, there's a lot of people who have that connection to the people in Sweda, for example, in Syria. And when they see them being violated, they get really upset and they want Israel to interfere and help the Druze in Sweda. And of course, the Druze in Israel and the remaining parts of Israel who are integrated, who are in the army. So I think this is why the change that you see in the Arab countries who've been occupied by Iran are actually a lot more advanced and evolved in their views than other countries who haven't experienced what people experienced in these countries that I just mentioned.
Avi, you've interviewed people from across the Middle East, from Israel as well, high-level figures, Mike Pompeo, many others. What was the most difficult interview that you've done?
That's a good question. You know, Yalla is basically a very kind of light and positive and generally a uplifting show. But after October 7th, we had to talk about what happened because nobody else was talking about the atrocities that were committed by Hamas. In Arab media, they literally, in the beginning, they were either denying that it happened or celebrating it, like Al Jazeera. So then they started acknowledging it. And then they were like, they had the Tawafan al-Aqsa, you know, as a hashtag. That's basically what Hamas called the operation, which is like the flooding of al-Aqsa, right? So the stories of what happened to the families, the Israeli families that were in these towns around Gaza and the hostages were never told. So one of the hard, I mean, I've had number of very difficult and emotional interviews with the families of the hostages, but the hardest was with the Bibas's, Shiri's cousin. Enough, I think her first name, but I don't want you to quote me. But Shiri's cousin's interview was the most difficult and emotional interview I've ever done in my life, because I'm a mother. And seeing two babies and hearing about their, you know, their life and who they were, and Shiri and her husband Yarden, who thankfully was released after. But as a mother, it's just the monstrosity of kidnapping a child. That's before we learned that they were actually murdered by Hamas. That was the most difficult interview I've ever done in my life.
Thank you for doing that. I mean, it's not easy. I'm sure the reactions in the Arab world were mixed, but thank you. It's really important.
Yeah, people were reaching out and they're like, we didn't know that. Like, they were like, really, this happened? Because they were never told what happened.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy how even in countries that joined the Abraham Accords, I mean, I'm not even going to say countries that have peace with Israel, because there's very little I mean, there's always hope, but right now the situation in Egypt and Jordan is not great. But even in Abraham Accords countries, where you would think things might be better, it seems that the media is still really virulently anti-Israel. Do you see any changes for the better?
Let me tell you, I think that in, like, if you compare, there's like the major news stations. Yes, you would say that Sky News Arabia and Al Arabiya are better than Al Jazeera. Yeah, absolutely. Are they better enough? Not in my opinion. I think that, and I don't think really, if you want to make a change, if you really want to enlighten and educate the population about so much history, so many untold stories, it's not only about news. You actually, I don't think even tell the news are like, I don't think they are the most effective way of changing the narrative or telling the truth. I think that softer content is the way, but like, I haven't really seen any media effort that is actually like serious or robust from Arab countries, including the Abraham Accord countries, towards changing the narrative with Israel. They are, you know, they interview more Israeli commentators or military, of course, like IDF spokesperson or from the government, or representatives from the government. But that's not how you change the narrative. Is something that you have a veil that you've been uncovering so much history, so much truth. You need to let it out. You need to talk about it. Nobody's talking about it.
Maybe, I don't know if our listeners know, but your name means hope. So I want to finish with a hopeful question. When we come and visit Syria after peace, after they join the Abraham Accords, what's the first thing that we should see and do?
I actually had, there's a soft spot in my heart for the old city of Damascus. I definitely think you want to go to the Jamiliyyah in Aleppo, which is the Jewish quarter my mom grew up in. And actually, that was my grandparents' house that I would go and spend the summer and spring breaks with my mom at every year. But I definitely think that you want to go to like the old city of Damascus. I think right next to it, there is a Jobar synagogue. This is, I think, one of the most ancient synagogues in history in the world. Unfortunately, it was damaged during the conflict between the Assad regime and the rebels. But, you know, this is what we need to work on, is rebuilding this. But there is a sense of spirituality in the old city of Damascus. And I definitely think that, you know, I kind of look towards that day where there will be like people from Israel visiting the old city of Damascus. And if I get to be with them, that would be amazing.
There's almost a cliche in Hebrew that I think it dates back to 30 years ago when there were peace talks between Syria and Israel that didn't go anywhere, that Israelis say that they hope one day to be able to eat the hummus in Damascus. The Israelis, for whatever reason, think that the hummus is much better in Syria. Actually, you've probably had both, so you can tell us, which is it better in Israel or better in Syria?
No, we talked about this on Yalla before.
Yeah.
Who does the hummus better? You know, conflict, a new conflict, because there's a lot of competition on food, including like between Syrians and the Lebanese. So now I'll bring the Israelis and have like, you know, a hummus war. Who does it better?
I'd be very happy to judge.
That would be the conflict we want.
That would be great. Yes. Thank you so much for being here. You have been a pleasure. It was very interesting. And we'd love to have you back sometime. So thanks.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I hope I didn't talk too much because sometimes I could.
No. We really enjoyed it, and I think our listeners will too.
Absolutely. It's been inspiring and hopeful.
Thank you so much, guys. I would love to join you again, and I would love to have you on, Yala, to talk about what you guys are doing as well.
Thank you for listening to Misgav Mideast Horizons. Make sure to subscribe, like, follow Misgav on all of your podcast platforms, on YouTube, social media, and of course we are at www.misgavins.org. And questions, comments, offers to sponsor an episode can be sent to MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com. So thanks for being here, and we will be back next week.